Hey, this is Katya on the Media's Executive Producer with something for the OTM completists out there. Jesse Thorne, host of Bullseye, has just launched a new podcast called The Turnaround. It's a series of long-form interviews with interviewers about interviewing, with people ranging from Ira Glass to Larry King to Marc Maron, and this week, with Brooke. Jesse really wanted to get into how On the Media is made and why it sounds the way it does. Here's what Brooke told him.
Your show has always been so tightly edited. I mean, like, it's like the worst you could say about it probably would be that it would be too tightly edited sometimes.
Oh, yeah. In fact, when asked about the program during some survey or other, one word that came up frequently was dense. And I think dense in this case meant really concentrated, to the point where if you cough or something, you might miss something. And that's not really conducive necessarily to the best listening experience. I mean, if you can't breathe or burp, then maybe you need to put a little air into the show, right? We've been trying to do that. Our interviews have gotten longer. I won't say languorous. They're still full of ideas and they're still pretty dense, but we give things more time to play out.
One of the things about doing radio specifically as a medium is that it is both typically a secondary activity for people, which is to say that they're listening when they're driving or doing the dishes, and also completely linear. And there's only one input. So if you space out listening while you're watching, first of all, when you're watching the television, it's probably the main thing you're doing. But also, if you space out listening while you're watching the television, you probably saw what happened. And if you look away for a minute, you probably, like, sometimes if I'm ironing my shirt while I'm watching the television, well, if I lose the visual, I can probably pick it up from the audio. And in radio, it is completely linear. There's no going back, and you're only getting that one thing. So if you miss something, you are out of luck.
That is true. And when you're listening to broadcast radio, it frequently is, as you say, a kind of an activity that accompanies some other activity. I think people might listen to podcasts a little differently, though. I mean, one thing I noticed about the truly brilliant and in no way overhyped Shit Town is that it wasn't as discursive to no purpose. It didn't spend as much time signposting and temporizing as say Serial did. And Serial was a great show. I mean, the first one. And it's said that, you know, Serial was thought of more as a TV kind of mini series, whereas Shit Town was more novelish, you know, more like a novel. And I think that if you're listening to it as a novel, you can't read a novel and focus on other things. So it sort of depends on how you want to produce it.
Are we doing media criticism right now?
No, I think we're not talking about interviewing, I guess, but we are talking about trying to have the form fit the medium. But if the medium takes different forms, then the form you use to convey your message or the style within that medium needs to adapt as well.
I want to talk about interviewing because
I thought so.
That's what the show is about. Your show is different in the tone of its interviews than other public radio shows, at least to my ear.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's true? You agree with that?
Well, I know that was our intention, lo, those many 16 years ago when we first started doing the program, that because we were a show that was critical of our colleagues in the media And because it was going to be much more of an analytical program than a news-breaking show, that we would practice what we preach and become more frank, more direct, more revealing of our own views, rather than doing the voice speaking from on high kind of style of an earlier era. We decided that we would basically lay our emotions and our biases out on the table, regarding them as data points that would be useful to the listener. And because we would be calling upon our colleagues to be similarly honest, not to engage in false balance, not to use awkward locutions like, what do you say to the person who says, when you're actually the one who's believing it and the one who's saying it? Now, sometimes you aren't the one, and then maybe in that case, that phrasing is relevant. But a lot of times it's just a way to distance a correspondent from their own views. And we weren't going to do that. We were going to own our views. I assume that's what you meant, Jesse?
Yeah, I do mean that. I think there's also a built-in contentiousness on your program. It's not an intense, it's not the kind of, structured for drama thing that you get on cable television news, for example. But I think that part of you guys, you and Bob, revealing yourselves more on the air is that when you disagree with what someone is saying, you will press that disagreement a few times, especially when they give you a banal answer.
Right. Well, that's just really believing that we are our listeners' surrogate and that we're not just checking boxes. This is certainly not unique to us. You hear it on the BBC all the time. You know, if you don't get the answer the first time, then you ask again and you ask again. And you cannot imagine, Jesse, how many times we ask the question and it doesn't come on the air. I mean, the idea isn't to edit to win the argument. The idea is to edit so that people can get an accurate sense of the way generally an interview went without beating a dead horse. So we may ask the same question various ways 6 times and only leave 1 follow-up or 2 on the air. And we do that because we know that the listener wants an answer. Hopefully we're asking the questions that they want asked. At least it's the ones we want asked. And we kind of assume that what we're interested in is generally what our listeners are interested in.
When you head into a work week, how many interviews are you personally going to be responsible for?
Well, in a regular work week, and there have been a lot of irregular ones lately, but in a regular work week, in a sense, I'm responsible for all of them because I do the final edit on all of them, generally. If I can't get to them all, then Kat will certainly step in and do the final edits. The producers do all the initial edits, and that's really the heavy lifting, because if an interview goes 40 minutes or 50 minutes or an hour, it'll get delivered to me usually somewhere between 10 and maybe 16 minutes, and then I take it down the rest of the way. But in that sense, I am responsible. I also make sure that if there's something inconsistent or inaccurate, you know, that if it jumps out at me, I'm sort of the final look at those things. I am responsible for doing about half of them. I mean, you know, this is a co-hosted program.
And what's that, like one a day-ish?
Lately our interviews have run longer. So generally I'd say that there are maybe 6 in a show, and it used to be more like 8. And so I'll do half of those. But the amount of conversation that goes into deciding and massaging the story precisely to fit what we think isn't going to have been covered by the end of the week, that can take lots of meetings. And then there'll be lots of pre-interviews where a whole bunch of people just don't sound quite right, or they well, they don't have the best grasp, or they don't, or maybe we need two interviews instead of one, and they'll be a little shorter. And so there's a continuous conversation. It isn't like, oh, we'll do these three topics, find us three guys, boom, boom, boom. This thing goes on and on and on. What you've heard isn't a show that's fully baked. It's been twice baked, three times baked, sometimes melted down and reconstructed before you've even heard it.
Brooke, it sounds like you live in a prison of your own construction.
A bird in a gilded cage.
So when you go into, like, I'm thinking of the most recent show as we record this that was not a special thematic show, which had a discussion of tax law.
Right.
And tax filing. And there were a couple of interviews, one with a journalist from ProPublica who was essentially advocating for European-style tax filing, which is to say the government sends you a piece of paper that says, we think this is how much tax you owe. Let us know if you're cool with this. And then you talked to a Virginia politician who is also head of the Free File Alliance, which is the
represents TurboTax and H&R Block, and who have strongly lobbied against the European system of a pre-file form because, obviously, it seems to them that it would be an unhealthy incursion onto their business, and this isn't something that America wants.
And this system of free file is, like, not used by almost anyone. It's used by, like, 2% of Americans, if I remember the number correctly.
They offer H&R Block and TurboTax and a dozen other companies offer the ability for you, if you make under a certain amount of money, which I think is $65,000 or $70,000 a year, to get their services for free. This is the deal they have cut with Congress and with the IRS so that the IRS doesn't offer its free service to everybody. And only 2% of people who are eligible actually use the service because they don't. Nobody advertises it. In fact, we got lots of mail after our thing saying, thanks, I didn't even know about this. So only 2% of the public uses it. 70% are eligible to get H&R Block or TurboTax or any of those companies to help them do their tax forms for free.
So when you walk into the interview with this ProPublica journalist who's written a big piece about this, what is in your hands and in your head?
What's in my head always is how has our view of taxes and filing taxes been framed by these companies? And what is available that people don't know about, that isn't in their consciousness, that could change that process, not just this free filing that they are obliged to do now, but also the possibility that we could, that the vast majority of us who don't have complicated taxes could get forms from the government. Even the millions of people who don't have to file taxes because they make so little and could actually get money back could be informed by the government about the fact that they could get this money back. That's hundreds of millions of dollars to poor people that are left on the table each year because they don't file taxes. If the IRS did the European way, they would know, they would get that money. All of that stuff, we try to put everything through the on the media Play-Doh extruder, as I always say. So it comes out on the media shaped. And for us, media and the shaping of perception by any means is the same. We use them simultaneously. So in this case, H&R Block has persuaded Congress that this system of free filing, which they would provide, is better, even though they hardly do it. And so it isn't strictly speaking media. We're not talking about journalism, but we are talking about the frames within which people organize their understanding of the world, and this was chipping away at that. We also look at what the stakes are. It struck me that the stakes were quite high for many people, and so that went in my mind, too. And so we talked about the lobbying efforts. We talked about what was possible, and I talked to the ProPublica person who'd done all the research on it. And then I talked to the Virginia congressperson who is the recipient of, who runs the Free File organization of TurboTax and H&R Block and the dozen other tax service companies, and who is a big advocate for using that instead of the IRS Free File, the IRS pre-file system.
So you sort of chewed up all of this information in meetings with your producers or in prep that your producers have done or that you have done to get an idea of why this matters, why it's appropriate for On the Media, and what the point is.
Yep.
How do you translate that into an interview? Do you have a list of questions in your hand?
Sure. I have fantastic producers. They provide me with a prep that has the fundamental, the basic questions that I need to ask so that the issues get out there. Also, quotes from ProPublica's article in the space under the answer, or maybe something that the person may have said in the pre-interview. So I absolutely believe in having a good, solid prep, because then I don't have to worry about the basics. Those have been offloaded onto the paper. I can therefore listen very closely to what they're saying without having to anticipate and hold in my mind what the next question will be. I'm a huge fan of preps. I mean, don't forget my background. I was an editor of Scott Simon's program, Weekend Edition, and the senior editor of All Things Considered for several years. I know what it's like when a major question has been missed, and I've done it myself. So I want all of that stuff on the prep. Then I can really listen to them hard for the questions that occur to me spontaneously in the moment. So I can be outside the interview and inside the interview simultaneously. The prep enables me to be inside the interview because the general framework of the interview is down on that paper.
Is it different when you talk to a ProPublica reporter who is, you know, their role on your show is essentially to explain the situation, and certainly their journalism had an element of advocacy in it. Like, mm-hmm. she clearly had a perspective on it,
mm-hmm.
that she shared. But I think that perspective was probably closer to yours and the show's perspective than this legislator from Virginia. So is it different when you're talking to somebody who you are leading through an explanation versus somebody that you know at some point, while there are elements of explanation, at some point there is an element of adversariality?
So you're saying when I know I'm going to disagree with someone, do I approach it differently in the interview? Is that what you're asking?
Or do you prepare differently ahead of time?
I still want him to lead me through an explanation. I absolutely do. Generally, it's because I see an inconsistency. I want to see if he can rectify that inconsistency. I'll give him every opportunity to rectify that inconsistency. And if I have to ask the question four times to piece together a great answer, I will do that and not show every single time I ask the question, just to get a really good answer. I really want everyone to sound their clearest and to, you know, this is why the show is so dense, to offer the most cogent explanation in the least amount of time. And that I can achieve with editing if they give me material to work with. If they don't, then those are the occasions where I want to assure the listener that we tried you know, I won't go on and on about it. It's not about me, but just to show that we didn't want to let them down as their surrogates so they can see the process, even if it doesn't yield anything, which is kind of what happened with that legislator a little week before last.
Audie Cornish told me, she's a host of
All Things Considered
news show, All Things Considered. Audie Cornish told me very emphatically when I asked her, is it ever hard to, you know, not offer your perspective on something when you're interviewing someone in a news context? She very emphatically said to me, it's not about me. You just said it's not about me, but you, I think, mean something different.
Yeah, it's not hard. It's not hard to hold back what you're thinking and what you're feeling. I just think for our purposes, it's not serving the listener as well to do that. I want them to have the data point. We have a lot of conservative listeners to our program who clearly identify us as liberals, but they know it and we know it and we still give them good information and they still find us fair. It is absolutely possible to be fair and to have a point of view as long as it's all out there. Like a movie reviewer that just doesn't get, you know, the work of Almodovar or something like that. That just sounds so Brooklyn, doesn't it? But anyway, doesn't get a particular director's work. So, you know, okay, I have to hold that in my brain when I read that critic's review of this movie. So know us. Know us. I think that this is an era in which knowing the person, being an authentic and complete person, actually builds trust rather than diminishes it. It's what David Weinberger said years ago, that disclosure is the new objectivity. Disclosure should be more reassuring. It is a sharing of trust than a kind of objectivity, the idea that you're, you know, one of this group of passionless priests of journalism that do their thing. That this is real people, people with expertise, people with experience, people with knowledge that you might not have on the particular subject area, but people nonetheless.
On the Media was formerly distributed by NPR. Like my show Bullseye is distributed by NPR, even though I make it and own it, or I and my colleagues make it and own it. And a year or two ago, WNYC, the station at which On the Media is based, decided to distribute its own show. So it's no longer distributed by NPR, but it was created as a show to be distributed by NPR and was distributed by NPR for something like 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
Was it a problem that you had this perspective at NPR?
Yeah, sometimes. We ran into some problems. Look, NPR didn't have shows of commentary and analysis. It had news shows. This had the sort of, you know, it had the look of a news magazine, you know, to use the old duck joke. You know, it looked like a duck, it walked like a duck, but it didn't quack like a duck. And it was difficult for it to get its arms around. And back in those days, 15 years ago, the whole tone of media coverage and commentary had changed. At that time, we were making a bold decision, which today has become much more the norm. And I don't mean that a lot of people are just shouting off a bunch of opinions and yelling and screaming and the volume goes up. I think we're very civil. And I think we're very knowledgeable, and the show is full of information, and it's won a Peabody and lots of other awards, and the rest of the industry respects it. But it did something different. It simply owned the hosts as who they were, and not as representatives of a kind of faceless, omniscient profession, you know? I think it's like, you know, back in the 70s, there's that famous story about how Walter Cronkite, the longtime and much revered host of the CBS Evening News, was voted in some small survey the most trusted man of the year in the 70s. And then you jump ahead and you ask young people, who's the most trusted man in, you know, in 2004 or 5 or some time ago? And John Stewart came up. Well, why? Because, you know, I think it's because John Stewart, for the exact opposite reason that Walter Cronkite, you know, won that little poll in earlier decades, because the nature of the relationship between the audience and the news producer has changed. The playing field has been leveled because of the internet and because of the constant back and forth. And that there's, I just think that if you try and be omniscient, you're playing by rules that no longer obtain in this environment. But that doesn't mean that you can't, that you shouldn't be fair and that you shouldn't be accurate. All of those things are more important than ever, especially when just the very nature of truth is under attack. But that doesn't mean you have to hide. And I think we were trying to be absolutely fair, absolutely accurate, but we weren't trying to hide 15 years ago or in January of 2001 when the show was relaunched.
Brooke, we're going to get to the nature of truth in just a minute. But first, I want to ask you, if you're representing yourself when you're talking to someone, you know, and you're trying to be a whole and authentic person and have your cards on the table and so on and so forth, while still being accurate and fair, how do you also serve as audience surrogate when the audience is often in many ways very different from you? Ideally.
Okay, I don't think that there's a real inconsistency there, because I'm just talking about being real, right? I'm still trying to ask the questions that I think need to be asked. Now, not everybody will agree with me, but not everybody would agree with me if I was pretending to be omniscient and had no view of my own. I'm still going to ask the same questions, because I'll still believe that those are the most important questions to ask. And in the case of the program, of course, we're not the only show, the desire for real, honest information has just gone through the roof. I mean, the downloads have exploded, listenership has really gone up, contributions that we haven't even asked for, which is good because our show is still not quite self-supporting after all these years. Thank you, WNYC. But the thing is that it's the same questions, it's the same cogitation, it's the same analysis. That doesn't change. It's just that I'm not hiding. So I think I'm still doing the best job that I can for the listener. The thing is that the listener simply knows who I am and they can factor that in.
Why do you think there are so many more, at least to my ear? I mean, I'm not a real journalist, really. but I listen to public radio on a casual basis. And to my ear, there are so many more direct follow-up questions on the media than there are anywhere else in public radio. You worked on traditional public radio news shows for years. Is it because they're being edited out? Is it because they're not being asked? Is it because you've chosen to ask more, or what?
I don't think they're being edited out. I think that a lot of public radio programs, like Morning Edition, or All Things Considered, where I worked, you don't get to sit and interview somebody for like 25 minutes to get a 6-minute interview or a 4-minute interview. You maybe talk for 10 minutes or something like that. What we do requires time. The interviews go on for a long time.
One time I talked to Bill Corbett and Kevin Murphy, who
from MST3K.
Yeah, exactly, from Mystery Science Theater 3000, and they're like friends of mine.
I just went to Riff Tracks last night, but that's okay.
Oh, great, that's great. Yeah, those guys are the best. They're just wonderful dudes. And I think Bob interviewed them one time when you guys were doing commentaries on similarly styled commentaries on political advertisements. And Bob, I think, interviewed them out of a sense of tipping the cap to the originators.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Bill and Kevin told me that at the beginning, Bob said, I'm not so sure I'm good at interviewing, so this might go on for a while. and Bill and Kevin were like, and yeah, we talked to him for like an hour and a quarter for that 10-minute segment.
Well, you see, that's just it. I mean, if you've got 5 things you need to ask, and you know you've got 10 minutes with them, and you know that they're not going to answer question 2, no matter how long you ask it, unless you really break them down, you'll try and then you'll give up. I mean, here, this is the problem with follow-ups. I'm not saying that they don't, you know, they don't want to do follow-up. I think there is a question of civility. You know, some people think that, pushing people hard on questions they don't want to answer sounds uncivil. But I think mostly it's just that there isn't enough time on Morning Edition and All Things Considered to do that. There aren't that many programs where the interviews go on for so long. Let me just say analytical type, commentary type. There aren't many programs like this, frankly. I mean, I know that at This American Life and at Radiolab, they'll take forever with a person. And they will craft it to make a perfect narrative. Our show is generally not narrative driven. I always love it when we do have a great story to tell. But often, our show is purely about ideas without that wonderful narrative storytelling structure to help power it through. And because of that, you know, we need to give the interviews an arc so that you can follow. And we need to get somewhere. You can't just check a box. When boxes have checked and we haven't gotten past that, lots of times we just kill the interview.
I want to ask you about that structure question, because I work in public radio, and when I talk about this, sometimes people think that I'm shitting on This American Life or whatever, when in fact the opposite is true. Like, I would not be in public radio if it weren't for This American Life. I love Radiolab. I love This American Life. I think they're so wonderful, such great programs and contributions to the world. So that is for real. Put that out there. But I think there are other structures to things besides narrative.
Right.
So one of the things I think that I find refreshing on the media and exciting about on the media is that segments on your show have other structures. There are other discursive forms other than anecdote, reflection, anecdote, reflection, anecdote, reflection, lesson.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That is true. In fact,
which is a great structure. Again, I want to be clear about that.
But it's not really the great. Only one. And I know that sometimes it can feel that it's all about stories. And stories are great. And, you know, I recently did a series that, you know, I'm really proud of. About poverty in America. And people told their stories, and it was exciting. It was thrilling to give them time to tell their stories. But always, it wasn't in the story that the lesson came out. The story helped explain in microcosm a larger problem, and then you got the larger problem, and then you got all this other stuff around it. So they helped propel the information and the context. Once I spoke to Lawrence Wright about, he's a fantastic nonfiction writer, and he wrote this famous book about Al-Qaeda called The Looming Tower. And I asked him about these amazing characters.
Brooke, thank you for explaining that to me. I'm very dumb and mostly watch baseball games.
No, it's all right. But it was a hugely important book when it came out, and it was deeply historical, very analytical, and it was full of characters. And I asked him, I said, it's just amazing the characters you have in your book, but there's just so much information. It's not just their stories, and yet they're so vital. And he said that he used his characters like pack animals to carry the information to the reader. And that's very much what I tried to do in Busted, America's Poverty Myths, was to use the people to create stakes for the listener to care about the other information, all the information that led to their situation. Anyway, that said, we were talking about follow-ups, and I was saying that I think that we're first of all, it's our intention not to let people down who are listening to the show, who really want us to try, and we're going to try. But more than that, we have the chance to try because ours is a weekly and not a daily show. Nor is it, strictly speaking, a live-to-tape show. Okay, we're going to talk for 20 minutes, and we'll cut it down a few minutes, just tidy it up, and it'll go on the air, which a lot of public radio programs are. This show is only about the content, and we ask questions knowing that it's not going to go on the air in order to ultimately get to our goal, which is answers to the questions that we think matter. Most people don't have that luxury.
What are the structures that you're thinking about as you conduct an interview that aren't the story of something, the narrative of something?
Right. Okay, so generally, if there is a peg, a news peg, we will write that. We won't ask them about the news because it might change. When you do a weekly show and you do an interview on, say, Wednesday or Thursday, things can happen. But we might throw some tape into the top, and then what we do is we get them to jump into the sort of heart of the issue first. At least that's the way I like to do it. And then we might step back and talk about history. We might talk about previous examples. We'll go to the main characters or protagonists in the story, talk about their background. Then we'll talk about the stakes, the larger message for everybody. And then, you know, Bob likes to end sometimes with a joke if it calls for it. We might ask them, you know, where they think it's going. There's usually an emotional peak somewhere, and that's usually the last answer or the penultimate answer, where someone has just been talking about this for long enough, they're very comfortable now speaking, and they'll just fundamentally say what drives them or what makes the story so critically important for them. You know, the question might be, why do you care about this so much? That's after we've established the news and we've got some basics. And then after that, we might just call it a day. If they bring up something that's weird that I haven't expected before, the whole thing could take a big left turn. And you go, wait a minute, did you just say this? But I thought blah, blah, blah. And if I say, but I thought blah, 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 and it stays in the interview, it's because I'm assuming that our listeners also thought blah, 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 and might need that correction. It's always about what we think we know, but that we don't really know, or that we're wrong about. Almost every single interview is about fundamentally that.
When you're
and after that, the last thing is, and why it matters. because that's in a pitch meeting, that seems to be, what are the stakes? Why does this matter? Why should I care? They have to go through all of that before we even begin the process of calling anybody or approving the idea. Okay. I just want to make sure that's on the record.
When you're taking an interview from half an hour to 6 minutes, how much do you change it? Do you switch things around? Do you re-record your side of anything?
No, Okay, I'm so glad you raised that. First of all, when an interview is only a half an hour, people are just, you know, dancing around the hallways because that's like the shortest they go. Usually it's more like 45 or an hour. And they rarely these days go to 6 minutes, so they almost always used to. Now they're more like 7 or 8 or 9 or 10. In terms of do I move things around? Yes. Do I combine answers? Yes. Do I combine questions? Yes. Do I post-record? No. That seems to be my red line. Even though we edit like mad, and I say this to every single person before I interview them, by the way, we edit like mad, but correct me in the moment if I say something wrong so that I can say it again, because I cannot record words that you haven't heard me say and put them in a question. I cannot do that. It's weird because I have so much freedom to make anybody say anything I want them to say if I chose to do that. Fortunately, this is a small staff and we share the same values and nobody has interest in distorting what people say, right? So we don't do that. But somehow there is an enormous danger for me in uttering words that they haven't heard. So no, I do not post-record, but everything else I do.
Why do you do all the other stuff?
I do that other stuff in order to create the most cogent, the most compact, and the most listenable interview that I can, that absolutely, the greatest extent that I can, reflects what actually happened. It's kind of like a hyper-reality. We talk about this little in probably the most popular piece we've ever done, which wasn't reported by either of us, called Pulling Back the Curtain. It was actually reported by a person we loved very much who later died of leukemia named John Solomon. And if you were to search the archives for Pulling Back the Curtain, you can talk about how we edit and why we edit, even though it's a very old piece. I think it's mostly pretty much still accurate, still true. But then again, you know, there are all sorts of different styles of editing, of interviewing that we do. When we edit for an interview, it's very different from when you're interviewing in order to get bits of tape cuts to go into a piece. That's a different process. Another thing about interviewing that I think is really important for anybody who's starting out is don't be afraid of silence. If you ask a question and they haven't answered, don't be all polite and jump in to fill the gap. Just let that silence fill the space. Let it fill. Let it roll over you like a wave. Because eventually that person will talk. And if they don't after that long silence, and you ask them again, or you ask them why they didn't answer, you are both being incredibly polite, but also put the pressure on them to provide some kind of response.
Brooke, we're going to have to refer the nature of truth over to your new book.
And it's a very, very short book, kind of more of a pamphlet. It's you can read it on one subway ride. I'll tell you the name, though, because the name is almost as long as the book. It's called The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time.
I want to ask you one last question before you leave to do the other interview that you have in 3 minutes. Are there questions that you're scared to ask?
Yes. I'm afraid to ask them because they're awkward and because they're personal, but there's also an edge of adrenaline that makes me want to ask them, because when you're asking hard questions, you really feel like you're doing your job, as long as the stakes justify asking these questions. And I try very hard not to have put people on the spot unless I feel that the issues have a direct impact on the way we see the world or on the way we live.
Like that it's worth it.
Yeah, it's got to be worth it. And not just because it's great radio, although that helps.
Yeah, sometimes I don't want to ask people about their feelings because I feel like why? So that I can, because I like their album. I'm going to bother them out there.
Well, I mean, they're there. I mean, I always thank people for giving us their time, even if I know they didn't really want to, or even if I know that they're selling something. They're still here, and they're still submitting to our process, such as it is, and they deserve a courtesy and gratitude for that. And that's, and then that's that. That informs the beginning of the discussion, and then how they treat me and by extension the listener by being candid or being evasive, by being open or being closed, you know, these kinds of things. The respect they show for the listener in their demeanor sort of determines to some degree how the rest of the interview will go.
Well, Brooke, thank you for being candid and taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you, Jesse. And I really think you should get someone to edit the interview.
I'm already losing money on this entire thing. Now you want me to pay professionals at professional wages or semi-professional wages to make you sound better? No way.
How about you?
I'm going to sound bad one way or the other. Editing doesn't help me.
Take care, Jesse.
Okay. Later, pal.
Bye-bye.
That was Brooke with Jesse Thorne for his new podcast, The Turnaround. Long-form conversations with some really interesting interviewers about interviewing. Check your feed Friday for this week's On the Media. Thanks for listening.